Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on SiriusXM. Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Coming up on the program this week, we bought Abby a hamster for her 8th birthday. When she's 28, do I have to buy her a house? A lot of parents of means have been helping their kids secure a down payment on their first house. Is this a good idea for you? Is this a good idea for your kid? Alan Denoyer, Senior Vice President of BMO Private Wealth, is here to help you think this through before you spend your retirement savings on their granite countertops. Then, how money assumptions may be getting in the way of your financial goals. Sarah Vermont, career coach and founder of CareerGasm, is here to tell you what these assumptions might be and how you can stop making them. Crazy about your credit score? Equifax Canada's Julie Kuzmic joins us to tell you how to improve your score and how long it will take you to do it. And Jacob Jackson from the Lean House Effect on why he believes there's no point in credit card points. His argument on why cash back is the way to go. Plus, feeling comfortable about retirement? Keisha Blair tells us about her latest book, Holistic Wealth, 32 Lessons to Help You Find Your Purpose, Prosperity, and Happiness. All that's ahead. Let's get started. Not many people feel 100% confident in their ability to live comfortably after retirement. This can be even more true for women. When Keisha Blair's husband died unexpectedly at age 34, she didn't realize how financially unprepared she was. In her book, Holistic Wealth, 32 Life Lessons to Help You Find Purpose, Prosperity, and Happiness, Blair offers a number of financial wellness tips geared specifically towards women. She joins us now from Ottawa. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. How are you?
I am well. Your experience really has informed the tips you provide in the book that you have written, and it began with a very tragic circumstance. Your husband, Garfield, died just 8 weeks after the birth of your second child, which is unfathomable, I think, to most of us. Tell us a bit about the journey from that day to today with you publishing this book.
Yeah, you're right. It started with his death, and that came as a total surprise. And, you know, like he really just came home from work, and we got to the ER, and within 3 hours, he was gone. And just to find out, it was the rarest of rare disease. And, you know, like, the doctors had no clue. It took 1 year for the autopsy. And so that's, you know, that story in and of itself lent itself to this because it was so unbelievable, so rare the circumstance. Mm. That I had to put this down in writing. I had to make sense of it. And so that started this journey. And, you know, it took me a while, but here I am today. And, you know, like, what's come out of it, which is great, is a framework for overcoming setbacks. And that's the holistic wealth method. And so, you know, this motivation from within that I came up with was that time that I had, you know, to really assess how to move forward, you know, with my finances, with everything. And so, yeah, so that's kind of, in a nutshell, how I got here.
What do you mean by the term holistic wealth? I have a sense for how I would describe it, but how would you describe it?
Yeah, and so, you know, in the book I talk about the traditional notion of wealth, you know, in terms of your net worth and your bank accounts and your investments, and that's the traditional sense of wealth. And, you know, in the book I talk about redefining that to include, or, you know, emotional health and our physical health, as well as our spiritual health, because I feel like all of those are like interdependent building blocks. And if you don't have physical health, it's kind of hard to have wealth. So that's what I mean. And of course, it stems from my experience. When I walked out to the hospital that night, they gave me all of his jewelry, everything in a white plastic bag. And I thought, wow, all of this is perishable. We really need to have solid building blocks. Mm.
Your book really is grounded in what you call six laws for life. Some of them might be familiar to some of our listeners, others not so. Given that this is a show about personal finance, we kind of look at it all through that lens, even though all of these laws for life you talk about, you can see how they would apply in lots of different areas. Which one or ones do you think is most resonant for you as it relates to money?
As it relates to money, I would say the law of abundance. Mm. And, you know, like that, I think that's the first one we have listed in the book, because It's kind of the framework for everything. And you know what? It's so funny that when we think about money, a lot of us think in terms of scarcity rather than abundance. And so that's why I wanted to bring out that law, because it really speaks to how I view things in terms of giving back and getting and giving and receiving. And so there's a law of reciprocity, too, that's there that links with abundance. But I think if we have, you know, like I talk about the holistic wealth mindset, and, you know, which is opposite to like a scarcity mindset. And so the law of abundance kind of channels all of that, because when we think of our money, we want to think positively. We want to think about being abundant. We want to think about having it. But so much of us, you know, we think about it in scarcity terms. And it's a mindset that some of us have grown up with, to think, you know, there's never enough money.
How long did it take you to find a way to apply that law in your life after those circumstances? Because no one would have faulted you for you to live in scarcity and grief and devastation for years.
Oh, yeah. And it's an amazing question, Bruce, because afterwards, I kept thinking, oh, my gosh, what's going to happen to me? And everything was grounded in fear. And I really had to take myself out of that mindset to move forward and think, you know what? You're going to be fine with your money. You're going to manage it well. You're going to create that abundance through your investments, through whatever you do, and your children will be fine. And so that's one of the major things that I had to deal with. And I want women to know that sometimes we suffer these setbacks. And, of course, it's easy to lapse into the thinking where you think, you know, like it's never going to be, but it's fine. And that's where the law of abundance kind of grounds everything, because it came out of, you know, that thinking that, yeah, like, you know, it's easy to lapse into fear, but no, like we can have that abundant life.
The law of reciprocity is another one that you bring up. A lot of families, a lot of women find that they are, their candle is being burned at both ends. There's no time for community. There's little time for kids. There's little time for sleep. There's certainly no time for Netflix. How can you fit in the law of reciprocity when you're not even caught up on Downton Abbey?
I know, and as you're talking, I'm nodding, because, like, that's something that we all struggle with. And I feel like in giving, we get back so much. And you know what's funny? Like, it came to me on my sabbatical that I mentioned in the book, too. I was in grief, and I just gave of myself. I took the focus off me. And I think sometimes once we do that, and I know it's hard to fit in, but in whatever way, small ways that we can, to take the focus off of us and do whatever, like small things, small random acts of kindness to help with, you know, taking the burden off, and it lifts our spirit and it makes us feel like, you know, yeah, I have some power. I can actually help somebody even in my state. And that's how that came forward in the book. And all of these are so grounded in, yeah, my experience and so helpful for each of us in living our everyday lives.
I wish we had an infinite amount of time. We don't, unfortunately, but I do want to get to some of the actions that you have that you believe people, women, but all people, can take to increase their holistic wealth. What are some of those actions?
Yeah, so I talk about money as being a big part of that, first and foremost, in terms of, you know, planning ahead and making those long-term investments that will help us be resilient and resourceful. And some of these could just be like this, a life insurance policy, whatever, long-term investments in a retirement plan. Those help us be resilient and resourceful. And then there's also journaling, setting a personal mission, because I feel like with setting a personal mission, that we outline what we want to become and align with our values and everything else. And so those are some concrete steps. I mean, there's lots more in the book that I don't have time to cover today, but, you know, the personal mission statement and getting the money aspects right, as well as taking time to reflect, you know, through journaling. And I have in the book some ways to do that in terms of, you know, jotting down positive messages and things like that. I think all of those are reinforcing.
You became a solo parent very, very quickly. What was the biggest challenge you had on taking full control of the family finances in the weeks, months, and years following Garfield's death?
So good, that question, Bruce, because here was the biggest piece. I inherited a life insurance policy. We had some long-term investments, but you know what I felt was missing? I felt like I didn't have a financial identity for myself. Mm. And I talk about that in the book a lot, especially for women, because a lot of us transition into adulthood without having gained a sense of our financial identity. We buy the first house, the first car with a spouse, the first major investment. And so we do these things and we go on and we think, yeah, of course I know what I want. But in terms of what we splurge on, what we save on, what's our investment identity, have we figured out that? I think that's the piece that some of us need to work on, and that I would say I hadn't yet figured out, but I realized when he died, I kept thinking, what would he think if I bought that? And so that's one of the key tests that we can use if we have figured it out. Because if we keep thinking, what would my mom think? What would my spouse think? What would my friends think with my financial decisions? We haven't really figured it out yet. And so that's the piece that I think it's critical, because it gives us confidence. And it gives us this sense of, yeah, I know what I'm doing. I have a handle because I know exactly what I'm doing with my finances.
Wisdom hard earned. We appreciate you contributing it to us in the form of this conversation and in the book. Thanks, Keisha.
Thank you, Bruce.
Keisha Blair, author of Holistic Wealth, 32 Life Lessons to Help You Find Purpose, Prosperity, and Happiness.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Real estate prices continue to skyrocket in many parts of the country. And even where prices have held steady, many first-time homebuyers are relying on financial gifts or loans from members of their family to secure their down payment. But how much should parents be willing to give their kids? Joining us now is Alan Desnoyers. He is Senior Vice President of BMO Private Wealth. Hello there.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
So anecdotally, we know this is happening. How common is it? Do you have a sense for how common this actually is?
No, it's a great question. I would say, first of all, it is something that we're seeing more and more taking place. And I would say, in particular in Canada, if you think of cities like Toronto and Vancouver, it's something that you're definitely seeing.
Yeah, there's just no way a person could afford a place if they didn't have a parental backstop.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. Is one, do you have the resources? When you think of affordability in cities like this, it's a key thing. When you think of across kind of developed countries, Canadian home ownership is actually high. It's very high. So we have this belief that everybody should own a home. We're actually not disadvantaged. But when you get to cities like Toronto and Vancouver, the affordability aspect becomes key.
So how would you work with clients to think this through for themselves? Because it's a multifaceted question. It isn't just, do you have the 50 grand or 100 grand to contribute to that down payment? There are emotional elements. There's questions of family values. What's the thought process look like?
And that's, I think you've hit the nail on the head. The key is not just to think about what's the dollar amount, but actually a couple of things have to be looked at. First of all, you know, you've created whatever the wealth is of your family. How have you built that up? Helping the children understand what got you to where you are in terms of building this wealth and perhaps having the capacity to help them. Then turning around and realizing what are the various steps that we need to look at in balancing the interest of the child or the young adult buying their first home or buying their home with the interests of the parent in terms of making sure that they're not, shall I say, mortgaging their future.
Yeah. My retirement savings.
Exactly.
In your condo.
Exactly. So it's looking at that and looking at it with a couple of other factors as well. If you help out a child in buying, if they eventually and are not yet with a partner, you're essentially contributing to that. And how do you want to do that? And to the question, the way you framed it, what are the emotional things that you're trying to solve for? And how do you do that properly? We certainly see, to your original question, a huge increase and a regular increase, I would say, in parents wanting to do this One, because of affordability, and two, perhaps a realization that it's not about what you're going to inherit after I'm gone, but more, how can I help when you really need the help?
I bought you a house. Be nice to me. You got to come for Sunday dinner because I bought you a house. That's what I'm thinking.
Okay.
You're a more evolved man than I am.
No. You're right. And we want to do everything for our children. But that also brings you to the other piece of how is it, what's the right thing? It's not just about helping them buy something without really understanding their financial situation and not encouraging to take on something that they really can't afford. This has to be sitting down at their individual plan. And if they are with a partner, what is that going to look like? What's reasonable? The last thing you'd want to do if your intention is really to help is to set them up so that they're going to fail because they bought something they can't really afford.
Such an enormous question, too, around temperament, because I can see for young people who have demonstrated no interest in personal finance or managing their money to suddenly have a mortgage. That could be an enormous pro because it's forced savings, and it can be an enormous con because they feel trapped or they feel unable to manage the maintenance and the taxes and the upgrades and all that stuff. What questions should parents ask themselves about who their kid is and whether or not this really is a fit for them?
Well, if you actually step even further back, financial literacy would be the jargon that you would use there. How do we begin to talk to children about money and at a very young age? And you've got a whole variety of tools to help you with that. But how do you begin to discuss what is a budget and how can you save money? But how do you equally need to save for a future? Not just I'm saving money for what I'd like to do next week. So the whole conversation around financial literacy and teaching people what is credit, what is savings, what is investing, what is good credit, what is avoiding getting yourself caught in really a treadmill of, oh my goodness, I've got bills that I'm always behind on. Or the last thing we really want to do is to see people that are stretched. So back to your point, financial literacy is something that we're now seeing governments and the like starting to say that we need to do.
I am one of six kids. If there was an investment like this with one of my siblings and not with me, there would be a lion's roar that you'd be able to hear on Mars. How do parents of more than one child navigate this without feeling like, oh my gosh, I'm going to have to spend $1 million with all my children?
Well, and you've answered exactly the question that also has to be looked at is what's fairness? And if I have a couple of kids, what's the right thing to do? Yeah. And how might I structure that? If I'm going to start with the first child, from a perspective of helping them, you use the figure with a $50,000 down payment.
Yeah.
How about what am I going to do for the other kids and what's affordable and what's fair for them? And if I do something with the first one today, how do I immediately protect in the event that I'm not around, something should happen and I'm not around to equalize later? So there's different ways through how you do your estate planning and the like to make sure through promissory notes, through how you actually structure your will so that that's recognized when you're actually not at the table anymore.
It would seem to be important to paper some of these conversations that you'd think you wouldn't need to, but you might need to. In that, I have one anecdote just top of mind where the purchase occurred, but the kid decided not to stay in the house. They were in a relationship. They moved to a different house. And all of a sudden, the parent is like, wait a sec. How did I suddenly own a condo? I wasn't planning on owning a condo. And then they had to sell the condo. And there was all this drama because there weren't clear expectations about how this was going to unroll.
Right. And that does come back to the core of planning. What is your plan? What is the financial responsibility that you see in your child? Is it, shall I use the word aloof, is it really somebody who's serious about what they want to do and demonstrated not just in the last month, but that they're saving for their contribution, that they are responsible with how they spend money, save money, and the like. And that behavior then at its core is what you really want to see if you as a parent are going to commit. And using that example a step further, if some parents decide they want to co-sign on a loan or a mortgage, well, if the child is no longer there to do it, you're still on the hook for it.
What should the kids consider? Because in some families, like, no big deal, of course, this would be great. In other families, this is a power play. And there would be a lot of dysfunction that could be magnified by this kind of arrangement.
Well, it is, absolutely. Because what you're bringing in is the element of emotion. And it's now we're talking about, there can be sibling rivalry. There can be, all of a sudden, you have to ask the question, if this falls apart, what's going to take place? To use your comment earlier, if you still want to have Sunday dinner together, there has to be some kind of, amicable discussion, shall I call it, of really making sure that we understand what are we going to do. And then to your point, absolutely, how does that get papered so that there's a clarity between parents or parent and child? And then if there are more children, so that there's a plan that really is reflective for everybody.
You raised the partner question. So maybe you help with the down payment when the kid is single, they get married. That asset then becomes shared within the context of the marriage, correct?
Yeah, depending on the nature of the contracts and the like, sometimes it necessitates people, if it's a more substantial down payment, to actually sit down and say, you know, are we going to talk about a prenup? Is there something, or is there another way? Is it a loan that I'm going to do rather than just gifting the money? Is it a loan that I'm going to secure? There's different ways that come back to the root of, you need to be planning. You need to be having discussions early around understanding the financial capacity of the child, understanding the financial capacity of the parents and the plans, and then saying, okay, if we think we want to move forward, how do we engage with professionals to find the right structure in which to move forward?
Alan, thank you for the insight.
My pleasure.
Parents, think this through. Please think this through. Alan Denoyer is Senior Vice President of BMO Wealth. Well, stay with us. Coming up on the show, we're going to talk to Sarah Vermont. She is a career coach and founder of CareerGasm. It makes me smile every single time I say that. We're going to talk about money assumptions and how they could be getting in the way of your financial goals. And later, why you should ditch your credit card points for a cashback card. Jacob Jackson is with the Lean House Effect. It's a blog. He did some interesting analysis here. If you want to listen to some more Moolala, any of the podcast platforms have our entire archive. You can also subscribe, review, and rate the segment. You can also go to the website. And there's a great search function on there, so you can look at topics that are of particular interest to you. Stick around. We'll be right back after the break.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
You've probably been told that making assumptions can be problematic. It's something like, making assumptions makes a mama cass out of you and me, something like that. I don't know. This can be true when it comes to your relationships and when it comes to your financial goals. Sarah Vermont, career coach and author of CareerGasm and Career Rookie. She is here to tell us about the top five money assumptions and how they're getting in your way. Hello there.
Hello, Bruce.
Assumptions make a mama cass out of you and me, I think is the song, right?
Mm-hmm.
You frame your thoughts with a story about an investment banker and her iPhone, specifically a client who says she couldn't quit her job to become a cheesemaker, artisanal cheesemaker. I love the visual imagery of that, without losing her fancy phone. You point out she's making a lot of assumptions, a lot. For example, what assumptions was
she
making?
Well, her biggest assumption is the assumption that most people have, and that is that you can't make money doing something you enjoy.
Right. I am a case in point at that. I'm kidding. I'm the exact opposite. You totally can. And how do you crack that? So you flagged that to her.
Yeah.
And did she kind of laugh at it when you pointed it out? Or did she say, no, it's true.
No,
there is no way I can make money being a cheesemaker.
She totally laughed at it. So what I did is I said, is it really true that cheesemakers don't have iPhones? And she paused for a minute and she was like, oh my God, I'm being ridiculous.
Right.
Like, of course they have iPhones. Like,
how else would they time the fermenting process or whatever it's called? They need that.
Yeah, so she had just tied the idea of fulfilling work and poverty together, which is something that a lot of people do.
In particular, people who pursue passion work from a very young age, like not-for-profit or the arts, or that sometimes when they come into money, either through career success or through some other source, they have a really hard time internalizing that they can actually have some money in their bank account and not be a terrible artist or a terrible contributor to the world.
Yeah, sure. Because another really common money assumption is that you can't have a lot of money and be a good person.
Yeah.
So that's another one that people run into. And I run into all kinds of these things because I help people make career changes. And naturally, all of your money fears are going to get triggered when you're thinking about changing the way you make money.
So enjoyable work is one. Greed is the second. A third one you flag in this blog post is about money and worthiness. What do you mean by that?
Well, some people carry the idea that they're not worthy enough to make money, or other people get to make money, not me. So there's some sort of weird situation, weird assumption around, you know, their personal value and whether or not they're allowed to make money because of their personal value.
Do you think this connects to the reticence from for many people to ask for raises?
Oh, certainly. And actually, very often women ask for raises far later than a man.
Oh, yeah. The data is ridiculous. It's shocking to me. It's
like,
crazy.
We don't even need another study on it because they've already been done. Yeah, all of them have been done. Mm-hmm. So it's often because of the way that we're socialized as women. We're less likely to ask for money because, heaven forbid, a woman asks what she wants because that's not what we're supposed to do. That's not what we've been taught. Yep. We're supposed to be there for other people. So this is an especially tricky one for women. We feel like we have to really, really earn it before we ask.
Right. Or if we earned it, they just give it to us.
That's
because
right.
surely they would notice and give it to us if
that's
we were
right.
worthy.
Yeah.
Another one you highlight is the link between the assumptions that we have about money and happiness.
Yeah. And there's two that are kind of related to money and happiness. One is the assumption that I will be happier when I have a lot of money. Mm. And a similar one is I have to be I have to make a lot of money now so that I can be happy later.
Right.
Those are really tricky ones for a lot of people. And, you know, to me, that sort of is a leftover from this idea that we were supposed to grind it out until retirement age.
Yeah.
And then we were allowed
to be happy. The pension kicks in and we're on the golf course.
Yeah. And of course, that can really sabotage the happiness that you might have before you hit 65, right?
And that's
a significant
long time.
Chunk. Yeah.
I mean, that's 45 years from the time you finish high school. It's a long, long time. There is also an assumption about money and time. So, you know, when I have money, I'll have more free time or.
Yeah. That's a pretty common one as well. We assume that more money means more ease and more time. And sometimes that's true. And sometimes it's simply not. Sometimes the more money you have, the more you have to hustle after it.
Yeah. And people with really big jobs don't have a lot of time.
Often that's the case.
Yeah.
That's true.
So how do you work with clients to illuminate the assumptions that they have that they wouldn't even describe as assumptions? They would describe as just the way, they would say it's just the way that it is.
Yeah. Well, a really common question I ask people is that really true? When I hear them say something that has sort of an undercurrent of an assumption, I'll be like, okay, let's just pause there. Do you really believe that, or is just some story that you've got in the back of your head? And in some cases, people really do believe these things consciously. Mm. But in many cases, it's almost like these beliefs and these stories are, if you're ever watching CNN, you see that ticker tape at the bottom of the screen.
Uh-huh.
It's almost like these money assumptions are always going in the background, but you don't pay too much attention to them. And that means that they're influencing your decisions and sometimes in a negative way.
So you have some awareness. You say, oh, okay, that's not the truth. That's an assumption. Got it. Step one. What's step two? What do you do? How do you remove the ticker tape on the bottom of the TV screen?
Well, what I try to do is help them sort of soften it. It's hard to remove it right away. But a really interesting question to consider is, okay, how do you behave when you believe that assumption? Like, how do you behave when you believe that you're not allowed to be happy now? You have to wait until you're 65, until you've got a ton of cash. Or how do you behave and how do you feel when you believe that only greedy people have money? It's impacting your decision making and the way you behave. And very often, if they see the connection, they can start shifting their behaviors.
Now, you're also not someone who serves people up a bowl of, you know, unicorns and rainbows.
No.
And if someone is making a career change from an investment banker to a cheesemaker, they may still have a phone, but they may not be pulling down 200 grand a year.
No,
so what's the distinction between your reality has changed, you're making cheese, awesome, love it, and you've made an assumption that you can't make any money and have enjoyable work?
Yeah, well, you have to decide what concessions you want to make. And so for some people, actually, everybody's a little bit different in terms of deciding what feels good for them, how much they need or they want. And it's so important to get clear and articulate what that want is and the need before you jump and make the career change so that you can go in clear-headed, knowing exactly what's coming down the pipeline for you.
If you could snap your fingers and change one thing about assumptions and money, and we've talked about five specific ones, what would it be? What would be the insight that you would love for everyone to have just as a function of having listened to our 8 minutes together?
Yeah, well, the most common one I hear is you can't make money doing something you enjoy. And I would love for people to just change the way they think about that, because the truth is there are so many people making a lot of money and a little tiny bit of money in most professions. It's this huge range in most professions. And so to attach a certain dollar value to a profession means people very often aren't pursuing the things they want to do.
I could be a big player in marketing had I stayed at Procter & Gamble. And instead, I was like, no, I want to be on TV. That's way more fun. And I'm so glad I did. So to, you know, to all of our listeners out there, career chameleons are a dime a dozen. There's a lot of us out there. And we can disprove some of the assumptions that you have talked about.
Yeah, that's true. And I'm one of them as well. I used to be a professor at a business school. And I took a big risk financially deciding to start my own business. And that was fine with me, but everyone has to decide what kind of risk they're comfortable with financially.
Yeah. Now, maybe I wouldn't have been a big deal in marketing. Maybe I would have been a big loser. It would have been a disaster.
Oh, you would have been a big deal.
And this is my saving grace. Sarah, thank you so much.
Thanks, Bruce.
Sarah Vermont, career coach, author of Careergasm and Career Rookie. We were talking about the top five money assumptions you might be making that might be holding you back in your financial goals and in life. Stay with us. Coming up later, we'll take Keisha Blair through the Moolah Law Questionnaire. She's an economist and the author of Holistic Wealth, 32 Life Lessons to Help You Find Purpose, Prosperity, and Happiness. But next, Julie Kuzmic. She is the Director of Consumer Advocacy at Equifax Canada. She is here to talk about how to improve your credit score. If you have missed an episode of Moolah Law, do not worry. You can listen to past episodes on moolahlaw.ca or on any of the podcast platforms out there. If you download the segments of the show, write us a review, subscribe, we would appreciate it. And future listeners would appreciate it because the algorithm puts our podcast in front of their face. Hooray for everyone. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
So you may have just found out you don't have what one would consider to be a great credit score. Or maybe it's okay, hovering just above 650, but you want it to be better. What can you do about it? Julie Kuzmic is the Director of Consumer Advocacy for Equifax Canada. She is here to tell us how you can improve your credit score and how long it is going to take. Hello there.
Hello.
So we know about the score. We know that it is important, and some people don't have a great score. They don't have a great score. What is the first thing you would tell them about time? Because isn't there that cliche that time heals all wounds? To some extent, a credit score just left for things to, if you're performing okay in the present, how much time does it take for your score to improve organically just because you're now doing things right?
Well, the very first thing I would say before even talking about time is to remind people that a credit score is not a moral judgment.
Good point.
Yes, there's a lot of shame around credit scores that could be higher. And you know what? If you're paying attention to it and you're starting to get your act together, good on you.
Yeah.
You keep it up. That is fantastic. And do not let concern about what has happened in the past drag you down.
Yeah.
That's a really important first,
very first
step.
Yep.
Secondly, time, as you point out. So there are regulations across Canada. Credit bureaus are actually regulated provincially, so they vary a bit by province. But what we do is take the most stringent set of rules and we apply it across the board, regardless of which province you live in. The regulations are intended to protect consumers so that negative events on their credit file aren't going to follow them around for the rest of their lives and prevent them from getting back on their feet.
Okay.
So something like a bankruptcy or an item in collections, all of these elements on a credit file, they have an expiry date, a certain amount of time where...
It's 7 years?
It's 6 years in most cases. So 6 years for both collections and bankruptcies. There are some provinces that say 7 years for bankruptcies. And what that's... It's a minimum, or it's a maximum, rather. So it is saying that within 7 years of the bankruptcy occurring, it must have been purged off the credit file. So what we do is we take the 6 years 7 years and applied across the board, which is doing people a favor who are in provinces where the 7 years would be allowed.
So to recap on the variables, we've talked about this before. Public record, which is the bankruptcy filing that you've talked about.
Yep.
Payment history, credit history, utilization, and hard inquiries. With payment history, you've lost your job, you've gone through a divorce, you can't pay your credit card, you barely make the minimum, you might not make the minimum at all. That's obviously a negative. Say you do that 3 times or for 6 months. Let's say 6 months. It's obviously a hit to your score. At what point does the computer forget that you did that? Because you then got a job and you got your life on track. How long does that hang on, those 6 months in which you couldn't pay?
That information usually will stick around for 6 years.
It will stay that time.
Yes, but the further it goes into the past, as time goes on, the less of an impact it's going to have on the overall score calculation.
I see. So it's a it's a pretty sophisticated algorithm then, if it can...
It is, and that's where the layers of complication come from.
Okay, what about utilization? Mm-hmm. So I was like way maxed. I'd run up all my credit cards at Christmas time. It was terrible. But then 6 months later, I had brought the utilization down to something reasonable. How long does it take for it to forgive me for that?
In my experience, utilization, it goes away pretty quickly. So it's not like a missed payment or a late payment, which can affect you for quite some period of time. In fact, it's not uncommon, and you see the odd media article outlining an example of this happening, where somebody makes a big purchase 1 month. So they normally carry a balance, let's say, of $5,000 on their $10,000 limit credit card, need a few new appliances. So they run it up to, say, $9,500 for 1 month and never go over their limit, pay it off as soon as it's due. There is a possibility that that data is reported to the Bureau at the time where your balance is $9,500, your limit is $10,000, so you're showing a very high utilization. It's not uncommon that people have a score drop, and sometimes substantially, for a very short period of time.
Right.
As soon as the next month's data comes in to the Bureau, you're going to see that score jump back up again, typically.
But enough to freak them out a little bit, because they might not know that it's a one-time.
Exactly.
Let's talk about credit history. This was a very real example. I was assessing my credit cards and trying to figure out, you know, should I get a different card? Should I get a new card? And one of the cards that I was looking at swapping out, I have had forever, like since 1987. At what point does that credit history, when are we in diminishing returns? When does it not matter? Like, do I need to have had the card for a decade? Or because that's, I guess that's like 30 years, does that make me bionic because it has been that old?
Well, I do love the use of the term bionic when it comes
to
credit scores. Yeah. So you clearly qualify for that.
Yes.
Now, I'm not sure that there is a point where it just doesn't matter. If you have the flexibility to do so, my general advice would be keep the old card around.
Right.
It's definitely not causing any problems.
Right.
You certainly want to make sure that you don't have any ghost recurring gym membership or something that is charging to it every month that you don't realize and you stop paying.
Right.
You know, that could get you in trouble. But pulling that card out occasionally and using it just to keep that card being active on your file
is not a bad thing.
That's right.
What are some of your top tips for people who want to improve their score?
The first one is, and again, it doesn't sound nearly as exciting as people want, but it really is all about making your payments on time.
Mm.
And if that means that you need to make a minimum payment, that is okay. That is still keeping up your end of the bargain.
Right. So
that's
it's helpful
you
to your score. It's not helpful to reduce your debt load, but it's good for your score. It supports your score.
Exactly.
And that one is so easy to do in that you call your bank and set up an automatic transfer for the minimum payment. Somehow the bank and the lender communicate. They can figure out what that amount is, and it's just transferred out. It's easy.
Yes, it is. That is a really quick win for people who are able to do that. Definitely highly recommend just making sure that at least minimum payment, and better if it's more than the minimum payment.
Yeah.
But if you're having a tough month and need to juggle things around, just make sure you are actually paying your bills. It will go a long way towards helping establish and then maintain a decent credit score.
What else? What else should people be focused on to improve their score?
If you have a short credit history, so that means if you've only started using credit in, say, the last year or two, maybe you're a young person who is just starting out, maybe you're recently arrived in Canada and establishing yourself, then I would say try not to open too many new credit accounts. Mm. That is the situation where those new hard inquiries on your credit file can have more of an impact because you don't have that nice, long, solid credit right. history behind you.
This was me in the 90s because you wander the mall and they're like, would you like a free ballpoint pen? Yes, I would. You have a t-shirt to go with that? And I ended up applying in particular on store cards, right?
Yeah.
I applied for store cards that I didn't need.
Yes, the lure of the free t-shirt. Shirt. It's a thing.
Yeah, it is a thing. I probably still have the t-shirts. What is different about store cards that people should know about? Is it simply that their rates tend to be higher than ones from bank institutions, or there are other ways in which that plays into the score?
There are some credit score versions which will treat score cards slightly differently from national credit cards. Mm. So just to use some examples, a store card would be, say, something from the Bay, where you've got a Bay card that is not also a Visa card. Mm. Of course, now you see a lot of permutations and combinations of these things where there's versions that are also a Visa card. So just trying to make the distinction right. there. But there isn't any generalization I can make for definitely always do this, definitely right. never do that.
I'm going to ask you to finish up on this question. If there was one misperception that people have about credit scores that you could correct for once and for all, what would that misconception be?
Checking your own credit file or credit score will never have an impact on the credit score.
Okay.
There is a general awareness of that connection between the hard inquiries we were talking about and the possible impact on a credit score. When you check your own credit file or your own credit score, that is always a soft inquiry mm. on your credit file, and it will never have mm. an impact on your credit score. So please don't be afraid to go. And that's really important. You can do it for free. You can get a copy of your credit file from both of the bureaus. I highly recommend people do that at least once a year yeah. to keep an eye out for any possible issues.
Knowledge is power.
There you go.
Julie, thank you very much.
Pleasure to be here.
Julie Kuzmic is the Director of Consumer Advocacy at Equifax Canada. Coming up next on Moolala, Jacob Jackson from the Lean House Effect is here to tell us why he believes there's no point in credit card points. And we take economist Keisha Blair through the Moolala questionnaire. So we're hanging out on the radio, but I also do a lot of TV. I'm the money columnist for CityLine, which is a North American syndicated lifestyle show. And you can check out any segments that I've done in the past at cityline.ca. Search for me or watch the show. Weekdays. I don't know where channel it's on, but it's on great channels across North America. Stick around. We'll be right back after the break.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
There is no point in credit card points. What? This is the argument made by our next guest. Jacob Jackson is founder of the Lean House Effect newsletter. He is here to tell you why switching to a cashback card is not only better for your bank account, but also better for the planet, too. He's going to have to explain that one. Hello, Jacob. How you doing?
Good. How are you doing?
So you began your post with the declaration that if you can't pay it off in full, don't get a credit card. Is that
Absolutely.
Accurate? You said that?
Yeah.
I totally agree. Why? Why do you say that?
Because most credit cards have a 20% interest. So if you carry a balance for just a month, you're already paying almost 2% interest a month. Which will offset any rewards that you get from having a credit card in the first place.
I wish everybody got this. This is pushback I get all the time because Canadians are ridiculous about their points cards. They're ridiculous about them. You completed an exercise comparing 10 different Canadian credit cards. What were you trying to illustrate with that math?
Yeah, I mean, you're totally right. The Canadians love their points. And, you know, they had a lot of passion involved in the responses
in this
article. So
were there some people who loved it and some people who thought you were a heretic?
Yeah, some people thought I was totally crazy because they got one first-class flight 1 year, and, you know, that must mean that points are definitely the way to go.
Uh-huh. So tell me about your methodology. You factored in a bunch of variables. I'm sure some of your critics said, you didn't factor in all the variables, but you factored in some. Tell us what you factored in.
Absolutely. I took into account sign-up bonuses, any points that you get for spending, any cashback that you get for spending. And then I took those amounts, and of course you can't invest any points that you get, so you can't invest your Aeroplan points, but mm-hmm. you can invest the cashback that you get. And so, yeah.
You also factored in annual fees. Some
yes,
cards have
absolutely.
Them, some cards don't. And in your math, you made the assumption that the user would spend about $2,500 a month.
Yeah, in that original post, yeah.
Yeah. Where'd you get that number from?
To be honest, that's the amount that I spend. And I talked to some people and figured out that was pretty much an average for someone making, you know, average salary in Canada.
Right. So, and you also assume, as you say, that someone would invest the difference. So in theory, kind of, they would transfer the cash back that they received on a cashback card to a separate investment account.
Absolutely.
It meant in your mental model. What rate of return did you assume?
I assumed 7% average rate of return.
That's pretty aggressive.
Market. Yeah, the goal is to save for the retirement, so the end of your career. And so if you're not at the very end of your career, the average rate of return over the stock market for a long period of time
right.
is about that.
And even if they don't literally take that cashback money and put it in a separate investment account, in theory, all things being equal, the math should still hold up because it would allow them to invest that money somewhere else.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah?
And if you look further down in the article, you compare if you spent all of your points on flights and then spent or in comparison, you spent your cash back on all the same flights, you still have money left over to invest.
Right. So take us through the results. I mean, the headline is over long periods of time, cashback wins over
Absolutely.
Points cards.
Yeah. And of course, the results boom in the long term. So after 10 years, the average person could save $4,000 to $5,000 by investing their savings in cashback. But by the time that you are maybe 40 years down the road for a millennial like myself, you're going to be looking at closer to $100,000 in savings.
Did it surprise you how different the results were? Or did you have, was this your hypothesis?
Yeah, I mean, I was surprised the extent to the difference. I knew that cashback was the way to go, especially
Why?
If you're trying to save money, because you just can't save anything when you're spending on points. You actually
Right.
are forced to spend more money because in order to use your points, you most often have to buy
taxes. A hotel and take a cab to the airport. Right. And you're going to, of course, buy that crazy I Love New York t-shirt while you're
yeah.
there.
And even on the flight, you have to pay the airport taxes, the fees and all that kind of stuff.
Now, you also make an argument about the environment. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so the goal of the blog is to show people that wealth does not come at the expense of the environment. And so you can actually create a lot of wealth while also protecting the environment. So each post talks about that at the end, what else you can do or how that what you're doing for your wealth will protect the environment as well. So in this case, if you aren't forced to fly everywhere because you have all these points to spend, you might actually take one less flight per year or one less flight every few years. And in doing so, flying is one of the worst things that we do for the environment. And so by taking that one less flight, you've made a huge difference.
Right. Given that I am compulsive about travel, that would be the part where I'd be like, I don't know about that. I'll buy the carbon offsets, but I'm still going to Europe.
Totally.
Am I a terrible person?
No, you're not a terrible person. Buying
you
the carbon offsets.
You think I'm a little terrible. think I'm a little terrible.
I fly a lot too. Yeah, it's just about doing what you can.
It was a limited set here, and I'm sure some of your critics said, but listen, you only looked at 10 cards. Why did you only look at 10? There's, what, 3,000 on the market? Surely
yeah.
that wouldn't have been much more work.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, of course, you know, in the comments thread, there's all these people talking about their credit card, and there are tons of different credit cards. I should have done more. I wish I could have fit in the thousands that you talk about, but these 10 were a good representative subset, and I think that they covered both you know, the large Aeroplans and the Air Miles of the world, but also the specific bank points that you can get, and then a good variety of cashback cards as
it's
well.
It's relatively easy to do the cashback math because it's like 1% cashback except for 4% on foreign transactions, blah, blah, blah. That math, you can plop it in a spreadsheet. How did you assess the value of the points?
Yeah, great question. So at first I was going to try and figure it out myself by looking at flights and all the things that you could buy. But I found a really great website called ratehub.ca, mm-hmm. and they have already done all that analysis. And so I was able to leverage what they had done to show what the value of each point was.
And is there a wide difference between Aeroplan, Air Miles, Avion, all that? What did you learn about how those points are valued?
Yeah, at the end of the day, the points could be an order of magnitude difference because, you know, you get 10 points for $1 spent on this program or 1 point for $1 spent on another program. But at the end of the day, what you could get with your points based on how much you had spent was pretty similar.
Right. Accumulating points is a exercise in frustration quite often because it's like, okay, I have all these points. I can't use them to fly anywhere because there's no inventory. It's infuriating.
Absolutely.
Whereas you say with cash back, even if you don't, let's say you don't invest the money and you just even mentally keep it aside and put it towards flights over 3 years, the value accumulates, but you have complete freedom on what you spend, what airline you fly and when you fly and no limitations.
Totally. It's about getting back choice over your spending.
What is next for the Lean House effect? Where do you see this in a couple of years? Are you, now that you've staked your ground on cash back versus points, is that going to be something you can continue to focus on?
I think I have a few things more to say about credit cards after having all the conversations that we've been having since I made the post. But it's not just about credit cards. It's going to be about a whole bunch of different things. I'm going to talk about ride hailing and electricity in your home and lots of other things that I have planned.
Jeez, is ride hailing bad for the environment too? Or should I do more of it?
It depends on the person. So I'm going to have to dig into deeply, but it can be better for the environment.
God, I'm a good person. Deep down, I'm a good person. Jacob, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. This has been great.
Jacob Jackson, he is the founder of the Lean House Effect newsletter, really looking at the intersection of the environment and personal finance. But what caught my attention was his analysis of cashback cards versus credit card points. Time now for the Moolala questionnaire. Of course, this is our series of questions about money and about life. And our guest today is Keisha Blair. She is the author of Holistic Wealth, 32 Life Lessons to Help You Find Your Purpose, Prosperity, and Happiness. Keisha, the first thing that comes to your mind, are you ready?
Yes, I am.
Okay. How would you describe your money personality?
I would describe it as thinking in terms of resilience and resourcefulness.
Resilience, the R&R. That's a new R&R. I love it.
Yeah.
What was money like for you growing up? Did you, you know, live in a land of lollipops and rainbows, or were there some struggles?
There were some struggles, and both of my parents were public servants, and it was a struggle because, you know, like it was tight at the end of the month, and, you know, even though we were considered, you know, like a middle-class family, like it was tight. Yeah.
Do you have siblings? Were you a part of a big family or a small family?
A small family.
Did you have a money mentor growing up?
I didn't have a money mentor growing up, but I did have a few people in my life who were investing for the long term, and that really had a big impact on me.
What were some of the early lessons that you recall learning about money?
I recalled learning that saving is so important. My mother would save to no end, and she would have pockets of money everywhere. She would stash them everywhere in, like, different banks, different credit unions, because she was a teacher at one point. And that was a big lesson to me. And my brother is another person who, once he started university, he started investing in real estate, and I thought, wow, and it really set him up for the future. So those two key people taught me a lot about saving and investing.
What is one thing, your kids are how old these days?
So I have three.
Three.
8, 10, and 14.
8, 10, and 14. So they're very much still with you at that point. What is the number one value in the area of money that you endeavor to imprint on them, either in tangible ways or just modeling that behavior? What's the number one value you would love to them to leave your home embodying?
I would love them to have, you know, the thinking that whatever they spend on, whatever they save on, should set them up for being resilient and resourceful. Because I feel like a lot of the spending that we do in the short term is just to get us through, to pay the bills, to, you know, put tires on the car. And I want them to start thinking in terms of resourceful, resilient. What do I do to make myself resourceful and resilient?
What is one of your guiltiest spending pleasures, assuming you have one, however small?
Yeah, travel. It has to be travel. And I everybody that knows me knows I have a weakness. And that
I have the same weakness, so I just think if it's a virtue. I have the same weakness, so I think it's a virtue.
Yeah, good.
We'll see you at the airport. When do you plan to retire, air quotes around the word retire, because that word has so much baggage on it, and what will you do?
Yeah, so my big plan is to retire at 55, and I want to write. I just want to continue writing and sharing my experiences and, you know, and really doing that full time. If I had the pleasure of doing that, that would be great.
If you could snap your fingers and change one financial behavior in society at large, what would it be?
It would be not having a life insurance policy. I see too many people without.
You mean that they should have a life insurance? A lot of people don't have one, and they should.
And they should absolutely have one. Yeah.
Yeah, and you have lived experience that demonstrates the importance of that with the death of your spouse.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Even at a young age, so important.
Yeah. With kids, it's mandatory. Keisha,
mandatory.
Thank you so much for your insight and your wisdom. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Bruce. This was great. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Keisha Blair, author of Holistic Wealth, 32 Life Lessons to Help You Find Purpose, Prosperity, and Happiness. That's our show for today. You can subscribe to it on any of the podcast platforms. You can just also tune in live on SiriusXM on the weekends. If you would like to send us some feedback, it could be thoughts, it could be questions, it could be ideas. Our email address is ask@moolala.ca. I'm on social, a little bit on social media, not so much. Facebook, Bruce Celery Moolala, Twitter @Bruce Celery. Thank you so much for joining us, and have yourself a great day.